It's Wednesday, February 26, 2014. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. As of this week, at least six Democratic attorneys general, that is, the attorneys general of their respective states, have refused to defend their own state's laws and constitutional amendments when it comes to the issue of same-sex marriage. It was last week that the Washington Post reported that the number of the attorneys general in these states now reached the number six. The attorney general of the state of Oregon was the last to join that list. The other states include Nevada, Virginia, Pennsylvania, Illinois, and California. But that was last week in the Washington Post. The real bombshell came yesterday in the New York Times. In an article by Matt Apuzzo, the Attorney General of the United States, Eric H. Holder Jr., advised the state attorneys general that they need not defend the laws or constitutions of their state if it violated their consciences. The article was based upon an extensive interview undertaken with the Attorney General by reporter Matt Apuzzo. And then the article reads like this. Attorney General Eric H. Holder Jr. on Monday injected the Obama administration into the emotional and politicized debate over the future of state same-sex marriage bans, declaring in an interview that state attorneys general are not obligated to defend laws that they believe are discriminatory, end quote. Before we even consider that the issue at stake is same-sex marriage, we need to recognize that something of a massive constitutional revolution has taken place in that single paragraph. There are so many complicated factors. First of all, by virtue of the Constitution, the Attorney General of the United States has absolutely no authority nor any role in advising the Attorneys General of the 50 respective states. For the Attorney General of the United States to decide to give an interview in which he will, through the national press, advise the state's Attorneys General, that's unprecedented. And then there is the actual argument that the Attorney General of the United States has made. His argument, as is made clear in this article from the interview that he did with Matt Apuzzo, suggests that the Attorney General is actually advocating that the Attorneys General of the respective states use their own personal consciences in deciding whether or not to uphold the laws and the Constitution of their state. Now remember for just a moment that the oath of office taken by the Attorney General in any state includes the responsibility to uphold the laws. What the Attorney General of the United States did not even mention in terms of the interview, or at least as appears in the article, is the fact that conscience should be involved in making an oath one does not intend to keep. The second paragraph in the New York Times article is absolutely perplexing. Apuzzo writes, quote, Mr. Holder was careful not to encourage his state counterparts to disavow their own laws, but said that officials who have carefully studied bans on gay marriage could refuse to defend them. End quote. That sounds like something right out of George Orwell or some kind of fictional writer. Indeed, science fiction. What sense are we to make of the Attorney General of the United States supposedly not encouraging the Attorneys General of the respective states not to defend the laws of their state, but on the other hand suggesting that if they did look carefully at the issue, they could, in good conscience, refuse to do that very thing? Even the New York Times reporter seemed to catch the unprecedented nature of what he was recording. He wrote, quote, It is highly unusual for the United States Attorney General to advise his state counterparts on how and when to refuse to defend state laws. But Mr. Holder said when laws touch on core constitutional issues like equal protection, an attorney general should apply the highest level of scrutiny before reaching a decision on whether to defend it. End quote. Later in the article, as if reading the minds of those who would read his article, Mr. Apuzzo writes, quote, His comments mark the latest manifestation of the Obama administration's evolving position on gay rights. Mr. Obama came into office opposed to same-sex marriage, but in 2011, he decided against defending the Defense of Marriage Act and ended the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy barring gays and lesbians from the military. The following year, the president said he personally supported gay marriage, end quote. That's a very interesting paragraph, and again, it's if the reporter knows exactly what his readers are going to be thinking. They're going to be thinking, what's next from this administration? In this case, you have the Attorney General of the United States straightforwardly saying in an interview with the New York Times, as he is getting ready to speak to the Attorneys General of the states in their annual conference, that they need not defend laws with which they basically do not agree. At least two state attorneys general responded very negatively to the Attorney General of the United States. One of them was Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen of Wisconsin, a Republican. He said, quote, "It really isn't his job to give us advice on defending our constitutions any more than it's our role to give him advice on how to do his job. We are the ultimate defenders of our state constitutions," end quote. Meanwhile, Colorado's Attorney General, John W. Suthers, also a Republican, said that attorneys general shouldn't be making decisions about which laws to defend. Quote, "I personally oppose a number of Colorado's laws as a matter of public policy, and a few are contrary to my religious beliefs. But as my state's attorney general, I have defended them all and will continue to," end quote. As even the youngest civic student in the United States comes to understand, we pride ourselves on being a nation of laws and not of men. That's the very expression that was used by those who framed our Constitution. But if we are indeed a nation of laws and not of men, what that means is that the law simply stands, and until the law is changed, those who are elected or appointed to public office must defend the law and obey the law. Now, in a case of extreme moral urgency, we can understand where a political officer, whether elected or appointed, such as a governor, a senator, or in this case, an attorney general, might be in the position of believing that a law is wrong. In that case, that individual should use the power of the office to which he or she has been appointed or elected in order to try to influence the legislature or the people of a state to reverse the law. There might even be, we would posit, some issues of moral extremity in which it would be absolutely impossible for someone in good faith to defend a law. But in that case, we would assume that this would happen in an extremely rare pattern. As a matter of fact, we would expect to see this maybe once or twice in a lifetime. Not six state attorneys general lining up in a matter of 2 years to say that they are not going to defend the Constitution or the laws of their states. But where in the world did they get this idea? We need to be very honest. They get it from President Obama and his administration. It didn't have to happen in terms of waiting for the Attorney General to make his statement in Tuesday's edition of the New York Times. President Obama has unilaterally acted in much the same way throughout most of his presidency. For instance, as was recorded in this article in yesterday's edition of the New York Times, it was in 2011 that President Obama, as the President of the United States, instructed his own Attorney General, none other than Mr. Holder, that he was not to defend the Defense of Marriage Act in the federal courts. That is an audacious act. And furthermore, it can be argued that it is an unconstitutional act, since the oath of office taken by the president involves his promise to uphold the laws of the land, not this law or that law, depending on whether he agrees with it. If we are to continue being a nation of laws and not of men, then we're going to have to make very clear that this kind of activity is not only ill-advised, it is illegal and unconstitutional and unacceptable. Shifting from the Department of Justice to the Department of Defense, earlier this week, it was disclosed that the Secretary of Defense, Chuck Hagel, intends to present a new defense budget that will amount to a massive rollback in terms of troop force and equipment in the United States military. As Dion Nissenbaum and Julian Barnes reported for the Wall Street Journal, Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel proposed a defense budget designed to turn the military's attention away from the long ground war in Afghanistan and towards emerging cyber threats from China and increasing challenges from Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups in Africa. In this case, the reporters went to the strategic issue before looking at the tactical. But then turning to the tactical, they write this. Mr. Hagel wants to pare back the size of the active duty military by 13% and the reserves by 5% in coming years. But he would boost the size of special operations forces by nearly 6% by adding about 3,000 personnel to the kinds of teams that killed Osama bin Laden in Pakistan. In announcing his budget proposal, the Secretary of Defense said, "This is a time for reality." But what is really interesting here is the massive rollback of troops. As a matter of fact, this budget projects a downfall in terms of the number of United States troops and military that would take the Army back to the lowest level it had before the ramp up to World War II. In other words, back to the early 1940s. This is going to set up a huge political controversy, and there is a good deal of heat to be presented on both sides, also strong arguments. We live in a dangerous world, there can be no doubt about that. America has learned that it has to have a strong military in order to protect not only our interests at home, but also our interests abroad. Furthermore, this dangerous world has been increasingly dangerous to human rights. And for that reason, the United States military has been used, rather necessarily so, always controversially so, in order to defend human rights elsewhere, even without direct reference to our own national security. There is no doubt that this kind of rollback is going to make those kinds of missions more difficult. It does reflect a very strategic shift towards special forces, indicating that the kinds of conflicts that the Department of Defense expects American personnel to need to address are going to be those that are rather high intensity, but small in terms of the number of personnel. This will be a huge political controversy in Washington, but it will not be as predictable as many others. In many cases, this controversy will cross partisan lines. It will have more to do, in many cases, with where defense contractors are located. You will find Democrats acting as hawks and Republicans acting at least partly as those who are ready to eliminate defense programs or defense installations in areas outside their own congressional district or their own state. What we're looking at here is a mismatch in which you have the intersection of politics and national security. You have the very real understanding that billions of dollars are annually at stake. And you have the very real question of what exactly is necessary to defend the United States of America and our national interests in a very chaotic, fast-changing, and treacherous world. In reality, we simply don't know. By definition, we do not know the direct threats of the future. These fall in the category of what former Defense Secretary William Rumsfeld called the known unknowns. We don't know it, but at least we know we don't know. Finally, from a worldview perspective, this kind of controversy reveals the fact that every nation, no matter how large, no matter how prosperous, faces some actual and quite natural economic limitations. The Department of Defense itself, within the national budget, faces some very real budgetary limitations. That means hard choices are going to be made, and as every family knows at budget time, or every church knows when coming up with its annual budget as well, these hard choices reveal deep worldview commitments. In other words, be ready for a very interesting political battle that will be not only about the military and economic matters, but the strategic vision of the world, the understanding of actual threats in an evil and fallen world, the reality that there are limitations upon the size of government. But how do we fit all these things together? That's what the controversy is going to be about. Oh, and one final issue, as was made clear in other coverage within the Wall Street Journal and other national media, the actual budget presented by the Secretary of Defense calls for an armed forces large enough to fight one conflict and prevail in that conflict, but not more than one conflict, which demonstrates the fact that we had better hope we have only one active enemy at any given time. Also in recent days, the governors of the 50 states met in Washington for their annual conference, and one of the big issues central to their discussion was marijuana. One of the central parties to the discussion was the governor of Colorado, John Hickenlooper, and his message to his fellow governors: go slow when it comes to marijuana. This is, he said, a massive social experiment. We don't know how it's going to work out. Now, this is the governor who has led his state through the process of legalizing marijuana. Not just so-called medical marijuana, but what is now called recreational marijuana as well. Governor Hickenlooper also announced in recent days that his state expects to bring in about $100 million in new tax revenue from the sale of marijuana. That's $100 million. As you might expect, that kind of tax revenue gained the attention of no small number of Governor Hickenlooper's colleagues, and yet he said go slow. Well, to be honest, it's very doubtful that other governors are going to take his advice. As Bloomberg News reported, Governor Hickenlooper said that about a half dozen governors called or asked him at last week's National Governors Association meeting in Washington about Colorado's experience legalizing recreational marijuana. They wanted to know about the potential to collect money and to avoid the costs of enforcement and incarceration. But the real issue of interest to the governors was the potential of tax income. As Governor Lincoln Chafee of Rhode Island said, the numbers announced by Colorado, quote, opened a lot of eyes, end quote. Well, of course they did. The states are always looking for ways to get additional revenue. And even as most states have budgets in excess of billions of dollars, $100 million is still a great deal of revenue. And when it can be gained by something as apparently politically popular as legalizing marijuana, you can see that many governors are going to try to rush to do it. It doesn't appear that the Democratic governor of Kentucky intends to be among their number. Steve Beshear said, quote, "I don't think that's going to happen in Kentucky anytime soon," end quote. That's probably something of an understatement. Meanwhile, when it comes to the reality of what it's going to be like to live with people who are smoking marijuana within our communities, the New York Times in recent days has published an article about the great difficulty in understanding how to deal with people who try to drive under the influence of marijuana. Maggie Korth Baker, reporting for the New York Times, writes, "If you are pulled over on suspicion of drunken driving, the police officer is likely to ask you to complete three tasks. Follow a pen with your eyes while the officer moves it back and forth. Get out of the car and walk 9 steps, heel to toe, turn on 1 foot and go back, and stand on 1 leg for 30 seconds. But as she explains, it turns out that people who are drunk on alcohol cannot perform any of those tasks and are going to fail at least one of them if they have any significant amount of alcohol. But even as other issues are impaired, those who smoke marijuana seem not to fail those tests. The field sobriety test, in other words, works for alcohol, but not for marijuana." Within this article in the New York Times is the very revealing debate as to whether or not driving under the influence of marijuana is as dangerous or more dangerous or less dangerous than driving under the influence of alcohol. It is clear that no one in this article suggests that it's a good thing to drive under the influence of marijuana. But as it turns out, even after marijuana has been legalized, not only in its so-called medical use, but its new recreational use in states including Colorado, the law enforcement officials are in no position to have any standard whereby they can make the judgment about sobriety and fitness for driving for those who are smoking cannabis. There are so many ironies in the situation of legalizing marijuana, and a shortage of ironies is hardly the case in Colorado. I mean, after all, in Colorado, you have a state that is famously intense in its hatred of tobacco and the use of the government and its laws to try to make smoking very rare. But you also have a state that is seemingly gung-ho for marijuana, for marijuana smoked the same way that tobacco was smoked. And furthermore, you also have the situation that you have the governor telling his fellow governors that they should not rush into marijuana because it is a social experiment on a vast scale. But the state of Colorado itself rushed into the legalization of marijuana, leaving many of the biggest questions unanswered. And they're still unanswered, such as, how in the world do you know when someone's driving under the influence of marijuana? What level of the critical ingredient in marijuana leads to what should be considered a criminal violation of law? How is someone going to be stopped? By what test are they going to be evaluated? These aren't hypothetical questions. The New York Times recognizes that there is no consensus. The governor of Colorado says, go slowly when he's talking to other governors. But they rushed right into it in Colorado, and they're not answering these questions either. Of course, while we're pondering the question of why they rushed so fast into this, let's remember that number the governor told his fellow governors, $100 million in new tax revenue. You can count on this. The Christian worldview tells us that in a fallen world, it's likely that other governors and other states are going to rush headlong and not delay to try to get that same $100 million or even more through the legalization of marijuana. Finally, at my website at albertmoeller.com, you'll find 2 new articles. I think both of them are important. The first one is entitled Caesar, Coercion, and the Christian Conscience, a Dangerous Confusion. This has to do with my answer to some of those who suggest that Christians should not support laws such as that recently adopted by the legislature in Arizona that offer protections to Christians in the business world in terms of their forced participation in something like a same-sex wedding. It's a very important argument. You'll find that article at albertmoeller.com, where you will also find the full text of my address delivered yesterday at Brigham Young University in a forum lecture delivered in the Coliseum there, the Marriott Center. You'll find it at my website, identified as Strengthen the Things That Remain, Human Dignity, Human Rights, and Human Flourishing in a Dangerous Age. You'll find these and more at albertmoeller.com. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me at Twitter by going to twitter.com/AlbertMoeller. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'm speaking to you from Provo, Utah, and I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.